Good morning. For years, there's been worry about the growing holes in the safety net for aging folks around the world because of fewer workers. But researcher Andrew Mason says there are some bright spots. We'll talk with him about the economic benefits of a low birth rate. And the political junkie Ken Rudin weighs in on Hawaii's gubernatorial and congressional races. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich on Friday, October 17th from member-supported HPR2. It's The Conversation.
Stories define our lives and our history. I'm Chris Vanderkirk, and this morning, one of the tales of Japanese storyteller Kuniko Yamamoto is how she's in Honolulu for a now-canceled festival. She'll give her insight into how telling tales is just as important as the tales themselves. And later, the story of Kauai's King Kaumali'i. Conversation starts right after the news. Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good morning, Chris.
One of the things that people of a certain age start to wonder is, are there too many of us?
Well, it's not just people of a certain age wondering that. A lot of people have been wondering about population issues for a very, very long time. You may remember that a while ago we talked to Paul Ehrlich about that. And for certain people of a certain age, the whole issue about population explosion was not far from their lips. But today we're going to take a little bit different take on that. Now, maybe you don't think a lot about the replacement rate, how new workers will take the place and help fund the retirement of an aging population. But UH economics professor and senior East-West senior fellow Andrew Mason does. He's just co-authored a global study on the economic benefits of low birth rate and why there's a sweet spot for countries who can find it. Andrew Mason joins us now. Thank you.
Pleasure to be here.
For a very long time, as Chris was alluding to just a moment ago, a lot of people have been concerned about that replacement rate, having enough workers to take the place of those who will be retiring or, you know, moving off the planet. But you say that we shouldn't be so concerned about a low birth rate. Why?
Well, you know, I think the replacement rate has sort of a magical sense to it in among people, because that's the rate that not only workers will replace the people who went before, but also it leads to zero population growth. And that's what people like Ehrlich were very concerned about, and many others. But our birth rates in maybe half the world are below that. And so eventually we'll have population decline, and populations that are much older than we've ever had before. And so naturally, people are very concerned about how we're going to pay for pensions and for health care for this growing elderly population and a shrinking population of workers.
You looked at about 40 countries. Who's doing it well?
Well, the United States
big surprise
is one of the countries that really has hit the sweet spot, as you refer to it, a new way to describe it, but I like it. And but other countries in Europe, Northern Europe, France, UK, Canada, Australia, all have birth rates that are a bit below replacement, but we think are actually the best for achieving material standards of living.
So what number does that look like? Because we've been told that we have, 2.1, and we've dropped just a little bit. So what is optimal?
Well, I don't know about optimal, but best,
Well, I mean, for that sweet spot.
Yeah. Well, let's say 1.7 births per woman would be the number I would throw out at first.
Which, of course, doesn't translate to real human beings, but we get the point.
Yeah, so it varies. It depends on the situation in the country. In some countries, they're putting a lot more into old age programs, and for them, having a low birth rate is a bit more of a problem. The United States, actually, our programs for the elderly are moderate as compared with Europe and many Latin American countries.
So if you're looking at shifting a lot of attention to have more babies so that there will be an appropriate replacement rate to let's take care of the people as they age and not worry about the babies, what does that shift look like?
Well, so we know people are healthier. And they're not just living longer, but they're healthier as well. And I don't know that everyone really understands that. And so we do talk about 60 being the new 50, I think, and 70 being the new 60. And there's no reason why people can't have a productive life for longer than used to be the case.
Well, think about many of the CEOs that you know who are still in their 70s and working and think nothing of it.
Well, that's right. And many CEOs, we see our own political leaders, and we see just regular people are working more than they used to.
Unless you're a judge.
Well, I noticed that.
But that's another issue.
70 is still the maximum age, but a lot of judges, I'm sure, would be perfectly capable of working well past 70.
When you look at other countries, though, that are not as fortunate as the United States in hitting that sweet spot, what do they have to really worry about now? I'm thinking about pockets in Asia and certainly Japan.
That's right. Japan and Korea, and then also many parts of Southern Europe, and like Italy and Spain, Germany. Well, their birth rates are very low. And their populations are going to get much older than in the U.S. And most of those countries, well, all of them have more generous health care and, well, pension programs, not necessarily health care, but pension programs than we have in the U.S. So they have to look very hard at getting people to work longer and reforming their pension system so that they are expect people to be a bit more self-reliant than they've been in the past.
Of the countries you mentioned, Italy seems to be a little bit of a surprise, at least on the face of it, because ostensibly it's a Catholic country. The idea of getting married, having children has been longstanding traditional or traditionally held value. But life is really changing in Italy, isn't it?
Yeah, that's a very good point. It used to be that Italy and other Catholic countries had much higher fertility than, say, Northern European countries. But that changed about 20 years ago. A lot of views about why that's the case. I think it has to do with the fact that to be a professional, to have a career and to have a family is very difficult in Italy. And so a lot of women are just saying they don't want to buy into that package. And so they're not getting married and they're not having children and they're pursuing a career.
And as they are opting out, it's causing a big issue for the country as a whole and other countries like it.
So, yeah, and I think that's the first step that they should be taking is to think about maybe there are barriers or costs, hidden costs to having families that can be attacked. A lot of countries also just try to provide support for child care and family, generous family leave policies and that sort of thing.
Oh, countries like Denmark and Sweden you're mentioning.
Yeah, okay. Those countries are doing those things, and they have much higher fertility than in Southern Europe. So,
but they don't have an extremely high birth rate. I mean, it's pretty comparable to ours, isn't it?
Yeah, it's about the same as ours. So the U.S. is sort of an unusual case in that we have relatively high birth rates, but we don't have particularly a lot of programs to support that. It just seems to happen naturally here.
So as you've sort of looked at a changed picture of what it means to have a lower birth rate, how does this inform policymaking, or how do you think it should inform policymaking as we go forward, particularly in the United States?
Well, I think the first thing is that Social Security is actually on a much firmer grounding than I think people act like it is. And actually, if you talk to people in Washington, I think they understand this. There need to be some adjustments made. I would like to see taxes raised a bit. I don't think the benefits are overly generous at all. They're pretty modest, and I think it's a wonderful program, and it ought to be funded. And then we have to keep healthcare costs under control. That's the big thing. The news has been really good the last 4 or 5 years. Medicare costs have not gone up nearly as fast as people thought they would. So we're doing something right. If we can keep doing that, then I think we're in pretty good shape.
And given the fact that longevity now, the latest on that is that people are on average living about almost 79 years, that's meaning that a lot of us are going to be around for a long time.
Especially you women.
Yeah, well, we have a little bit of benefit there. What you lose on the turns, you gain on the roundabouts. You don't have children. I guess that's kind of sort of fair, maybe not, if you're living without your beloved partner. Andy, thank you so much for coming in.
My pleasure.
Wish we had more time to talk about the study. It's really interesting work. Thank you. Andrew Mason is a professor of economics at the University of Hawaii at Manoa and a senior fellow at the East-West Center. He's the co-author of the East-West Center and UC Berkeley Global Study on the Economic Benefits of Low Birth Rate.
And this is The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2. It's 8:16. And later in the show, a storyteller from Japan who folds origami, magic, and music into her shows. But first, your quiz.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we're looking at American singer-songwriter Jason Mraz, soon to be performing in Honolulu later this fall. He was born in Virginia, but got his big break in San Diego after playing in coffee houses for 3 years. Over the length of his career, his musical genre has evolved from blues and smooth jazz to pop, reggae, and surf rock. He's also known for his social activism by headlining benefit concerts for social change and creating his own foundation in 2011. It supports other organizations promoting social equality, nature conservancy, and music education. But for today's quiz, we're looking at a music video of one of his songs that was shot in the islands. This song was used, the song used multiple locations, including the H1, Hanalei Pier, and Manawili Falls. Can you name that tune? If you know the answer, tweet us at HI Conversation. And if not, well, stick around. We'll give the answer later in the show.
When life gets hard, lucky I'm in love with my best friend. Lucky to have been where I have been. Lucky to be coming home again.
Think whole grain foods and probiotics are new food trends? I'm Ira Flatow. Join me on Science Friday for a look at the life of Dr. John Harvey Kellogg, who pioneered many of these diet innovations over 100 years ago. Plus, we'll dig up the microbiome of plants, all from the University of Notre Dame, on Science Friday from PRI.
This morning from 9 to 11, right after The Conversation.
Be too simple to label Kuniko Yamamoto as a storyteller, although she certainly is that. Magic, music, mime, and especially the ancient art of origami figure prominently in her shows. She's in town for the now-canceled Storytelling Festival, Talk Story Festival. It's been postponed by storm warnings, but we wanted to seize an opportunity to hear from her, and Kuniko's in our studio this morning. Good morning, Kuniko.
Good morning. I should say aloha, right?
You should. Well, you can.
I love the sound of the language here.
Well, I just before we started, I taught
humu,
you.
Humu, nuku, nuku, aua.
Apua'a.
Apua'a.
Yeah. That's a lot of people's favorite Hawaiian words.
That's a wonderful sound to it.
It's also our state fish. So you see, you learn something from coming.
Absolutely. And then that's what it's about. I go to all over the United States and then go to different countries. And then I learn the people and the way of life here, the way of people, the way of the stories are.
And it's very much that's very much the life of a performer, isn't it? People think of performers as putting something out everywhere they go, and they forget how much they can get back. Yeah,
absolutely. And then all what I do, I shouldn't say all, because some of them coming from my childhood,
sure,
and then the way I developed in my life. But majority is so much fed by the people I meet in a different land.
So, because in some ways your art has very old roots, right, in Japanese storytelling, origami.
Absolutely. And then I always say the storytelling and origami goes together very naturally, because origami creating out of something fantastic, out of nothing.
Yeah.
And the storytelling is the same way. And they were so organic, down to the earth, and it comes from the people's eyes and the mouths and the ears and then hands. And then that goes so together. And then no wonder it's the oral tradition is ancient.
Yeah.
And then from the day one we were on the earth, it was there. And then the origami from the day one paper appeared, even the leaves, even before the paper time, people folded. I have no doubt about that. So origami is so ancient too.
I hadn't looked at it that way before, but it is kind of a something out of nothing.
Right.
Just as the way you pluck a story out of the air.
Yeah. It's almost like a fold to unfold.
Uh-huh.
And I just love that kind of phrase to think about.
So there's a lot of, you incorporate a lot of visual design.
I do.
Into your shows, as well as mime, which is in a way using the face to make pictures, right?
Uh-huh. And it's so funny, you know, when I was in Japan, I was studying dance, theater, and then I wanted to do mime. And one day I saw a great mime, Japanese mime, who studied with Marcel Marceau,
the great
French mime.
Yeah.
And then she was fantastic. And then I was so mesmerized. How you do it without the words, and then your body talks so much. So I wanted to study. I came to the States. I studied with Tony Montanaro, which is a great mime.
Yeah.
And then how in the world I turn into a storyteller, right?
Yeah, you're not supposed to talk, right?
That's right. But it's the same thing. How you express yourself.
Sure.
How eloquent you become. And it's the art of it. And you can break rules here and there. And it's not breaking rule, as a matter of fact.
Well, to me, I once saw Marcel Marceau toward the end of his career. And just a guy on a bare stage. There was nothing.
Uh-huh.
There were no props. There was nothing else. And it struck me how much incredible courage it takes to go on stage. It's about as close to naked as you're ever going to be, right?
And it's such a great feeling. And storytelling is the same thing.
Yeah.
You just create the world. You know, you come in as a naked body. And then on the stage, you just, it's almost like an origami. You come out with a piece of small paper. And then you just open it. And then you fold it into the moon, the castle, and the king, and the evils, and the monsters. You fold it into it and then show it to the audience. It's such an excitement.
I guess I was going to ask you where that confidence comes from, because it you can't go on stage, a bare stage, without a great deal of confidence that you're going to get you're going to reach people, right?
Right. It's like if I'm Kuniko and I'm shy Japanese woman.
Uh-huh.
But on the stage, it's just almost like I am the soul of Kuniko. You know, it's just like it doesn't matter how good I look or how bad I look or how much make a success on the stage or it's somehow it's a different universe is on the stage. And then it's hard to explain how I come up with that dare to perform. I don't know. I can't explain it.
Well, because a lot of performers, 2 minutes before they go on stage, they're terrified.
It is right? Terrifying. But somehow your soul backs you up. And then even you don't know what to say when you're on the stage and then look at everybody. Just, I'm here to share with you. I'm here to entertain you. That was such a great divine feeling.
Sure.
I don't know how it works, but it works for me.
Well, I think a lot of people who find themselves in that position sort of reassure themselves that those people out there sitting in the dark, they want you to succeed.
Absolutely. And no one came to just you fail.
To see you be terrible, right?
Absolutely. I would just punch them on the face, you know, if they were not good. But yeah. No, I shouldn't say that. But that's how the performance is. And then also the storytelling is. Just like, you know, you and I, just face-to-face, and hey, let me tell you this story.
Sure.
And then, you know, that's... it could be bad, it could be good, but we're just sharing the time, and then we're going to have a good time together, right?
Do you sometimes start a story and not necessarily know where it's going to take you?
Sometimes. Oftentimes.
Because that can happen too, right?
That can happen. And then when I have somebody, like you facing to me, and you correspond, and then I pick up, it's like a catch ball. You
yeah.
know, you throw the ball, and then I throw it back, and then somehow you rescue me.
Well, Kuniko, you've rescued me this morning. It's been great to meet you.
Yeah, great to meet you.
Yeah, good talking to you. Yeah. Kuniko Yamamoto is a storyteller born and raised in Japan, performs in theaters, schools, colleges, and festivals across the country. She'll be part of the city's Talk Story Festival, which has been postponed to early November, and you can find out more at hpr2.org.
Support for today's programming comes from Ballet Hawaii, presenting Stars of American Ballet with principal dancers from the New York City Ballet, Saturday, October 25th at Hawaii Theater. Ballet Hawaii.
Sometimes you just need a ride, and while that might mean you call a cab, a lot of people are calling services like Uber and Lyft. That's gotten under the skin of traditional cab companies, and as we talked about a while ago, those companies are pushing for regulation and said so at an informational briefing this week. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair picks up today's reality check. Good morning.
Good morning and Aloha Friday to you, Beth Ann.
Yeah, and it's a darn good one, isn't it? Being that we finished the drive yesterday.
Yay.
It's nice to have a full show today, too. But as we're looking at a conversation we had a while ago about cab companies concerned that, you know, they have to abide by regulations. Well, why don't those who drive for Lyft and Uber X?
It's a good question. It's something that Echo Cabs, Charlie's Taxi, and others have raised, saying, look, what you're really doing here is skirting the law and you're creating unfair competition. So what lawmakers are wrestling with is exactly what they can do about that. Now, that's unclear because some wonder whether this is a matter of a county situation. Are they the ones that are involved here in dealing with this? Or is this a state matter, getting a permit like you have for transportation network companies? So these are the sorts of things that lawmakers are wrestling with. Nothing is going to happen at least until next session, but I wouldn't be surprised if you saw some legislation coming along to regulate Lyft and Uber and other types of services like this.
So how is it that, you know, Uber X is, you know, just not in compliance, but its fancier service, the Uber Black, is?
These are the kind of questions that have people scratching their heads, and we can tell you the company representatives were there, and they say, look, they're abiding by the law. But you're right, there are some double or triple standards here, and that's frustrating people. You know, one of the things that was asked is whether the Public Utilities Commission could do a cease and desist, right, have these companies stop until the legislature figures out what to do. But that's probably not going to happen. Mina Marita, the director there, said they don't have the resources to do that. But that double standard is a big concern, and that would be the whole purpose of legislation, is to clarify the law, the regulations for these ride-sharing services.
Meanwhile, those ride-sharing services are going to go on, and lots of people are making what they consider to be good money doing it. We'll see what kind of pushback happens once we hit January. And for the moment, we'll say goodbye to you and have a happy weekend. We'll talk to you on Monday.
You too. Get some rest, my friend.
Thank you. Plan on it. Chad Blair is a political reporter for CivilBeat.com. In our local news, there's campaign mania at every turn, and with the election now 2 weeks from Tuesday, it's only going to intensify. As many of us are caught up in the fray, it can be helpful to have an outsider's opinion. We called political junkie Ken Rudin to get just that, and he joins us now. Good morning, Ken.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Thanks very much for being here. Looking at our primary, we had a drive to defeat an incumbent governor. And we also had, you know, two Dems who were duking it out, not what the rest of the country was seeing. Did that really make for a more interesting primary, perhaps, than the general election we're going to have in a couple of weeks?
Well, in these one-party states, and of course Hawaii seems to be a one-party state, although they do elect Republicans to the governorship every now and then, but in one-party states, it's the primaries we pay attention to. But what's fascinating about Hawaii, of course, is that when you think of the primaries this year, you think of the disruption in the Republican Party. You think of the Tea Party Republicans against the so-called establishment wing of the Republican Party, and they've been battling from all the states for the last two or three election cycles. Now, when you thought of Hawaii this year, all you thought about was the Democratic primary for the Senate, for Brian Chatt's Senate seat, and it just seems to be pretty remarkable that in a state where everyone, in a country, when everybody's concerned about ideological wings on the Republican side, you have one state that's really, that it's with the Democratic primary. Whoever wins the Democratic primary seems to win in November.
Also, the fact that we had such a movement toward the primary, with people looking to see whether or not Governor Abercrombie would be able to make it through, or whether, in fact, as many predictions had it, he wouldn't and would go down in a landslide defeat. Still, we had this very low turnout, Ken. What do you make of that?
Well, it's certainly not just exclusive to Hawaii. We think of all these states, and you're trying to get, first of all, part of the problem is that a lot of people are not happy with Congress, and that's true about both parties. But even in races for governor around the country, in California, where they opened up the election system to get more and more participation in it, in the primary, 18% of the eligible voters voted in California. So that's not a Hawaii problem, but I mean, people will say, well, if you give us better candidates, we'll get more people voting. But I think it's more significant than that. And I don't know if it's just distrust and unease with Washington, or the sense that government is not working both nationally and at the local level. But clearly the trend is going for smaller and smaller turnout. And that's not good for democracy, obviously.
You mentioned, and we talk about this all the time, about how we're a shades of blue state. Yet we've got a pretty close race, or what seems to be a pretty close race, between the Democratic candidate Mark Takai and GOP's candidate Charles DeJoux for the CD1 seat. What do you make of that?
Well, I think there's several reasons. I mean, the reason it's close, of course, is because DeJoux has been in Congress before, even though he only served 7 months. But, I mean, his argument is that, look, think of what life is like in Hawaii. Everything is so expensive. Gas is expensive. Food is expensive. Electricity and things like that are so expensive. And so maybe we need a different approach. And DeJoux will make the argument that as a member of the majority party, and everybody expects the Republican Party not only to keep the majority in the House, but to extend it as well on November 4th. He'll make the argument that, you know, I have an opportunity for the majority in Congress to pay attention to Hawaii. But Mark Dekai is doing a lot of tactics similar to what you're seeing other Democrats around the country doing, that whether it's legitimate or not, whether it's true or not, he's running against an opponent as being a Tea Party Republican. Now, I mean, just from what I've observed from DeJus 7 months in Congress, he is hardly an ultra-conservative. He's hardly a Tea Party Republican. But again, it works in many states. And in a state that is loyally Democrat and overwhelmingly Democrat, as Hawaii is, perhaps it's a tactic that could work.
Ken, I mean, you're making the point that he's not a Tea Partyist. He says that DeJus says he's a centrist. How does that sync with what you see?
Well, I think he is kind of, I mean, given, well, in all fairness, the Republican Party has moved way to the right in Congress. I mean, John Boehner finds himself battling the Tea Party as much as he does battling fighting Democrats. So, but I think because the Republican Party has moved so far to the right, it would be kind of silly and misleading to think of DeJus as one of the Tea Party faithful. So he probably is in the center, but of course, maybe the center in Congress may be far to the right in Hawaii politics, and that's the argument Dekai is trying to make.
As that shift has been occurring, do you see this as being a potentially good thing for Republicans in Hawaii?
Well, I mean, you know, I mean, I think that's the frustration that a lot of Republicans are saying in Hawaii. Of course, there are not a lot of Republicans in Hawaii, but if there were, there would be a lot of complaining about saying that it's not working here. I mean, given all the problems we have with expenses, you could make the case that, you know, it failed under Abercrombie. It's failing under its solid Democratic leadership in the Senate. Of course, as I always like to point out on my podcast, no Republican since Hiram Fong in 1970 has been elected to the Senate as a Republican from Hawaii. So Republicans say, look, why don't you give us a shot, you know, and see what it's like? But the Democrats could say, well, we see what's going on in the House with the Tea Party and the ideological battles that are going on day in and day out. Maybe that's not what Hawaii voters are looking forward to.
Yeah, just a couple of years ago, we saw the end of Linda Lingle's reign as governor. Where was that an aberration?
Well, you know, something. Whenever you think of people being elected to the Congress, whether it's Linda Lingle, you know, to the governorship, or you know, when there's an open House seat, when Democrats are fighting each other, I mean, that's basically how DeJus won elected to Congress several years ago. He just, you know, there were Democrats battling each other, and he took advantage of it. So, I mean, that's basically that's how Republicans seem to win. The question is whether they can hold on to it. I mean, this is another battle. You see, in the governor's races here, you have a battle between the Democratic nominee and the former Democrat, you know, the former mayor of Honolulu, Mufi Hanneman, who is theoretically could split the Democratic base. But the Republicans need more than a split Democratic opposition to make their case in Hawaii. And maybe if one of these guys, whether it's in the governor's race or DeJus in Congress, if one of them wins, then perhaps they can make the argument that this is what the Republican Party stands for.
Okay, let's talk about that, since you brought up that three-way race, which some pollsters here say really isn't a three-way race. You're really looking at Iona and David Ige, who we spoke at length with last night on Town Square, but that with Mufi Hanneman, it gives him the opportunity to say things and to do things because he is running as the, you know, the third dark horse situation, that he can say things that might be uncomfortable for others to say. Does that put him in a unique situation?
Well, it certainly puts him in a comfortable position, and, you know, I watched some of that debate, and, I mean, if anything, Hanneman looked pretty relaxed and sure of himself and confident of the facts. I mean, you can make the case that it's a solid Democratic state, and the polls will show that, you know, that Ige is ahead because of the Democrats are so used to winning in Hawaii, although we did mention Linda Lingle. But then you watch Ige in the debate, and he seemed kind of like stammering and unsure and a little, you know, tentative during the debate, whereas Hanneman had this very breezy confident style. So sometimes you can have all the issues in your favor as you want, but sometimes personalities make a big difference. We always think of Bush versus Gore in that debate in 2000, and Gore was supposed to wipe the floor with Bush, but Bush came off as very comfortable, is very relaxed in his own skin, much more so than Gore, and that may have swayed some voters as well. So don't discount the personal aspects to candidates in these kind of debates.
Do you think, given what you've just said, then, that it's not going to be so much of a slam dunk for David Ige?
Well, I don't know what a slam dunk means anymore. I mean, everything, we've been surprised by so many things this year. There have been so many surprises. I mean, the Abercrombie, even though we knew he was in trouble in the primary, I mean, he just got clobbered. And you see there's a bunch of unpopular Democrats and unpopular governors around the country, but they still survived the primary. I mean, this was a wipeout. So who knows what's going to happen? I just kind of think that, you know, I mean, I believe the polls. I believe that Ige has the lead, and I'm sure that's the case. But you know, surprises have happened. You know, Pat Psyche was not supposed to win when she won. A lot of surprises. We'll see what happens. I think Ige wins, but it could be closer than the polls indicate.
All right, one last question, Ken. Is Hawaii really in a new era in its political history, and not just because that some of these faces in Congress have been changing since the days of the Dans? Are we really in a new place?
Well, it's, you know, what's interested me, and I like how you put it, the era of the Dans. I mean, that has changed, but it seems like, forget about Democrats versus Republican Hawaii, it seems like there is a cultural change going on in Hawaii. There's a difference between the old, Inouye kind of leadership with Hawaiian-born and Asian candidates, and more white and younger candidates. So there seems to be a cultural divide, a generational divide in Hawaii that may be less about Democrats and Republicans. It may be about the future of Hawaii versus the past, and that could be the future of Hawaii politics as well. I mean, does Hanabusa run again in 2016? A lot of things we're looking forward to, and again, the Democrats still have to get their act together, at least their party in order, because these two wings of the party seem to be still colliding.
Which means that we get to have another conversation, I hope, sometime in the future. Thanks very much, Ken, for joining us this morning.
Thanks so much.
Ken Rudin is an expert in politics and campaign history. And for most of the past 20 years, Ken was the eyes and ears of NPR's political coverage in his position as a political editor and resident political junkie.
Earlier in the show, we asked you which Jason Mraz song used the islands as the setting for its music video. This video features multiple locations on Oahu and Kauai, including Hanalei Pier, the H1, Monowili Falls, and Mokoaia. And the answer is I'm Yours. The single was released in April of 2008, became the first song to top the AAA Adult Top 40 and Adult Contemporary charts. The music video was released in March of 2008, and in November that year was featured as the Record of the Week on Scott Mills' BBC Radio 1 show. To date, that music video for I'm Yours has gained over 190 million views on YouTube. And if you're a fan of Jason Mraz, you may be excited to know he'll be returning to the islands to play 3 shows on Maui and Oahu in December of this year. It's 8:47. And that's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Tori Richard, a Kama'aina company, creating clothing for the Hawaiian island lifestyle since 1956. Proud to support local, national, and international news programming on HPR. ToriRichard.com.
Memories of King Kaumualii, the last ruling monarch of Kauai, have faded for many, but many on the Garden Isle are working to keep them alive for a new generation. Alitha Kauhi says she's surprised how little some students on her island seem to know about the man who reigned over Kauai and Niihau from 1794 to 1810. She's determined to change that, honoring his legacy with a festival of food and original music in Waimea Town. She's on the line with us this morning. Good morning, Alitha.
Good morning.
He is one of the fascinating figures of Hawaii history, huh?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well,
tell me a little bit of his story as it came down to you, would you?
Well, I think I'd like to give you some background of how this all started. It seems like even our children do not know who the king is.
Mm-hmm.
And the group formed themselves in 2004 called the Friends of King Kaumualii.
Uh-huh.
And their purpose was to commission a statue of the king. Well, having no photo of the king,
Saw
several renditions of his likeness. The project waned and the organization became inactive. But in October the 12th, Lee Croft, author of the book, George Antoine Schaeffer. Now, Schaeffer was a very important figure in the Russian occupation here on Kauai.
Right.
And the book was called Arm Wrestling with Kamehameha I, which contained an interesting likeness of King Kaumualii.
Uh-huh.
It was illustrated by Hawaiian artist Brooke Kapukuniahi Parker of Honolulu. When I saw that photo with no name, I had chicken skin. I said, "Is this Kaumualii?" And the author said, "Yes." Well, the author has given the friends unlimited use of the painting. I met Parker, and I asked him, "How did you conceive this painting?" He said he visited the museum countless times, researched, and did a lot of pondering.
Because there are written descriptions of what he...
There are written descriptions,
yeah. Yes.
And so this painting sparked the reactivation of the friends. Now, I've been criticized because it doesn't have the likeness of what people have written about him.
Well, Alitha, before we get too much in the tall weeds here, let's back up and establish who he was. He was the...
King Kaumualii was the last king of Kauai.
Yes.
He ruled until 1810.
Right.
Kamehameha made two attempt invasions to Kauai, and he failed.
Right.
But Kamehameha knew of Kaumualii's mother, who was very powerful spiritually.
Mm-hmm.
And during her time, it was said that she prayed a ban around the island. No one could penetrate. Well, in 1810, Kamehameha had already realized that maybe Kaumualii still had the mana of his mama, of his mother.
Right.
And so he, he had this great army, or what you'd call his military force, that was going to come to Kauai.
Well, he had an armada of ships. He was planning
also,
a serious invasion. And
right. But also, there weren't canoes, there were ships, there were guns, there were cannons.
He had Western
weaponry.
He had
weapons, which the Kauai people could not at all stand an inch against him.
So they negotiated a peace, right?
Well, let me tell you.
Okay.
Kaumualii's kahuna said to him, "You have decided to go to Honolulu. Kamehameha is going to offer you two stones, a black stone and a white stone. Whatever stone you choose, that is going to determine the fate of this island."
Wow.
Kaumualii was offered the stones, as predicted by the kahuna. And commonly it chose the white stone, which was peace.
The path of peace.
Yes, and the black stone was death.
So an invasion.
Kamehameha was a little, what the Hawaiians would say, pu'iva. He was surprised.
Yeah.
He must have his mama's mana. And so he invites him to be the ruler until his death. Of course, under Kamehameha, which Kauai did agree. He did escape. He did not stay for the party that night. He had been warned that the chiefs did not like the idea that he was given to remain as king as long as he lived, because then they couldn't come to Kauai and be the chiefs of the island. And they had planned to kill him. Kamuli listened. He left the island and returned to Kauai. He fulfilled his duties as he promised Kamehameha, but in 1821, he was kidnapped by King Kamehameha II, Liholiho, and I'm sure influenced by Queen Ka'ahumanu. So that's the story, and we just want to perpetuate his life.
He chose the path of peace to avoid bloodshed and conquest by violence. Is that
that's
accurate?
Correct. Yes.
So that sets an example right there, doesn't it, Aletha?
Yes. And that's the example we want our youth to know, that this man, you know, like all kings, I'm sure he still wanted to get back his island, so forts were built and all of that. But basically, he was a peaceful person. Yes.
Well, Aletha, thanks very much for talking with us. It's really a fascinating chapter
in
Hawaii history.
Well, we have invited songwriters.
Yeah, we're going to send some people your way,
October
Aletha.
October the 25th, right.
Aletha Kauhi is one of the organizers of the Festival of Stars and Flavors of Waimea, Na Mele o Kaumalii. It's a week from tomorrow, October 25th, at C.B. Hofgaard Park in Waimea Town, and you can find out more at hpr2.org.
Michael Tittenden here. A thousand thanks to everyone who helped bring this season's fundraiser to a close. The goal of slightly over $1 million was surpassed at 7:45 Thursday morning, by which time 3,015 listeners had called in with their pledges of support. You had us going there for a while, but now it seems that the health and growth of Hawaii Public Radio for the next 6 months is assured. Many, many thanks, everyone.
He really is a political junkie, isn't he, Beth Ann?
Oh, you're talking about Ken Rudin?
Ken Rudin, yeah. I was really, it was great to hear how well-informed he is, because I've viewed with alarm at some commentaries on local politics coming from the mainland. They seem to miss key details, but he was pretty on it, wasn't he?
Well, that's why they call him a junkie. I mean, there are just certain details that he holds on to and he does his research. But looking at it from, you know, the perspective of someone who's not enmeshed in all of this, as we usually are, because we live here, we have a vested interest, but looking at it with a little bit of distance, a little bit of perspective, was what we were hoping we would get from him. And clearly he offered some of that.
Sure, because Hawaii, from that perspective, is definitely seen, as he said, as a one-party state. And there are clearly shifts in that landscape, but it's going to be an interesting election.
It'll be a very interesting election, and very interesting how he looked at us with the perspective of how our primary made us very, very different. We always say we're different about many things, and certainly our primary made us look a lot different compared to all the other states. That's going to do it for us for this week. Coming next week on Monday, economist Paul Brubaker has his analysis of the Maui Initiative. We're going to look at the scenarios that he envisions.
And there's a call for artists on Hawaii Island with coffee as its theme.
Well, in the meantime, you can let us in on your radio talkback on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, on Twitter at HI Conversation, or at BKOZHPR.
And if you want to hear today's show again, get another past show, our links to more information, there's an archive on our website, hpr2.org. Our executive producer is Bethann Kozlovich.
Lillian Song produces the program, and Taylor Rice is our production assistant. And thanks to Casey Harlow, who is filling in for Lillian this week.
And the Backyard Quiz theme was written for us by John DeMello. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Bethann Kozlovich. We'll see you next week when we pick up the conversation. Have a good weekend.